27, Freud, an atheist who was deeply committed to moral behavior, published a critique of religion, The Future of an Illusion, the illusion being God and religion. Freud did not fear the breakdown of belief in God would have any moral implications among intellectuals. Civilization has little to fear from educated people and brain workers. In them, the replacement of religious motives for civilized behavior by other secular motives would proceed unobtrusively. As Dr. Freud was to witness within 10 years of his statement, civilization has as much, if not more, to fear from educated people as from the uneducated. Freud's fellow Austrian and German intellectuals showed no more moral insight or strength than any other group of Germans and Austrians. What Germany lacked during World War II was not enough educated people, or for that matter, artistically sophisticated people, see following paragraphs, but enough good people. Many would counter here that Germany lacked enough good people among the religiously educated as well. They would be entirely right. The failure of German Christianity was horrific, but the moral failure of German Christians, with noble exceptions such as Dietrich Bonhoeffer, is almost universally acknowledged, even by virtually all Christians. On the other hand, the moral failure of secular education and secular intellectuals in Germany is almost universally ignored. Art. Art can uplift the spirit, elevate the human being, and illuminate the human condition. And it has done all that primarily during religious periods in Western history and or by God-centered artists. For example, the man widely considered to be the greatest composer of music was Johann Sebastian Bach. This is not a Eurocentric assessment. It is a view held by Japanese, Koreans, Chinese, and other non-Westerners just as much as it is by Westerners. In Bach's view, the aim and final reason of all music should be none else but the glory of God and the recreation of the mind. Another musical giant, Franz Joseph Haydn, the father of the symphony and of the string quartet, began the manuscript of his compositions with the Latin words In nomine Domini, in the name of the Lord, and ended his manuscripts with Lauds Deo, praise be to God. Probably the most widely known of the great composers, Ludwig von Beethoven, though not as overtly religious as Bach or Haydn, thought the greatest work he ever composed was his music to the Catholic Mass, the Missa Solemnis. As belief in God and Christianity declined in Europe in the late 19th century, and especially after World War I, classical music deteriorated, as did the other arts. The Death of God, pronounced by Friedrich Nietzsche in 1882, and the near death of great art are related. I asked one of the preeminent orchestral conductors of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, Sir John Eliot Gardner, if he agreed with this assessment. I assumed he, not known to me as a religious man, would respectfully disagree, but he completely agreed. In fact, Gardner often notes the words soli deo gloria, to God alone the glory, are the words Bach wrote on every manuscript of every one of his more than 200 cantatas. Much of postmodern, post-Christian classical music and art came to celebrate the ugly and the meaningless. More and more, art has even celebrated the scatological. In 1987, a photograph by the American artist and photographer Andre Serrano showing a crucifix submerged in a jar of the artist's urine, titled Piss Christ, was an award-winning work of art shown in museums and galleries throughout America. In 2011, a German sculpture depicting a lifelike policewoman squatting and urinating, even the puddle is sculpted, received an award from a prestigious German foundation, the Leinemann Foundation for Fine Art. In 2013, the Orange County Museum of Art in California placed a huge 28-foot sculpture of a dog outside the museum, where it periodically urinates a yellow fluid onto a museum wall. In 2016, one of the most prestigious art museums of the world, the Guggenheim in New York, featured a pure gold working toilet bowl, which visitors to the museum were invited to use. The name of the exhibit was America, so one could literally relieve oneself on America. These are but a few examples of prestigious museums in the Western world showing scatological art. There are hundreds, likely thousands of works of art composed of urine, fecal matter, menstrual blood, or depicting scatological acts. And there are an immeasurable number of works of art depicting nothing. Paint droppings, blank canvases, unidentifiable objects, and the like. All these works are the antitheses of art produced by Leonardo da Vinci and other God-centered artists who made most of the greatest works of art. There were great works of art, certainly great for their time, prior to Western civilization and its affirmation of God. But those pre-Western artists, such as the Greeks, also believed in gods higher than themselves, if not in God. The same holds true for the beautiful works of art in many non-Western civilizations. Although not all art needs to be God-centered, and some great and/or beloved art, from Claude Monet's water lilies to Pablo Picasso's Guernica, have not been, the overall trajectory of the art world since the Bohemian, often anti-God era of the 19th century to today, has been a dramatic diminution in the quality and transformative power of art. In the West, when God dies, so does higher culture. And in the many other countries where secularization has become the norm, there has been a similar decline in the arts. Moreover, even great art and music produced by God-centered artists and composers doesn't necessarily elevate those who appreciate and love it. When art is not a vehicle to God and God-centered morality, it often becomes a morally worthless false god. That explains how cruel human beings could love beautiful music and art. Hollywood director Stanley Kubrick vividly made this point in his classic 1971 film based on the Anthony Burgess novel A Clockwork Orange. In it, men rape and murder while classical music plays in the background. This was all too real. The Nazis forced death camp prisoners to play classical music while Jews were led to gas chambers. Rudolf Hess, the commandant of Auschwitz, the largest Nazi concentration and death camp, played classical music in his house after gassing up to 10,000 people, mostly Jews, each day. As one who deeply loves and appreciates classical music, I have periodically conducted orchestras much of my adult life, it has been painful to realize people could cry at Mozart and then support or even commit murder. But the realization that art, when valued as an end in itself, does nothing to make a person good and may even enable bad people to think they are good, because many people equate being cultured with being good, was one of the most important and depressing realizations of my life. As we shall see in the chapters regarding the building of the tabernacle, the Torah clearly maintains aesthetic beauty in the service of God, such as the art of Leonardo da Vinci is magnificent and important, but not otherwise. As the early 20th century American rabbi Emil Hirsch put it, to the Greeks, the beautiful was holy. To the Jews, the holy was beautiful. Love. Even love can become a false god. When morally directed, love is incomparably beautiful. But it is not a moral guide in and of itself, any more than art or education. In the 20th century, tens of millions of people put love of country, which can be a good thing, or of race, which can never be a good thing, or of an ideology above moral considerations, and evil resulted. Over the course of 40 years, I have asked young people in America if they would first save their pet or a stranger if both were drowning. A smaller and smaller minority have said they would save the stranger. Why would the majority save their pet before a human being? Because, they say, they love their pet and they don't love the stranger. In other words, they follow the dictates of love. That is one reason the Torah and other books of the Bible warn us against trusting our hearts. See, for example, Numbers chapter 15, verse 39. And why stop at a pet? If love is the sole criterion, why not save your family photos or your beloved car before a stranger? Surely most of us love many things more than we love a stranger. Love, like education and art, must be morally directed, or it too can be a false god. Even love of fellow human beings needs to be measured by moral standards. Since we cannot love everyone, what type of people do we choose to love? Do we love evil people? Nobel Prize-winning novelist Saul Bellow put it this way. A man is only as good as what he loves. Joseph Telushkin makes the point that Bellow's words should be kept in mind when we hear of people who love vicious individuals. The women who loved monsters such as Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and for that matter, mass murderers in prison and myriad other men like them, albeit on a smaller level of destruction, put love above morality. This commandment against false gods made the ethical revolution of the Bible and of the Ten Commandments, what is known as ethical monotheism, possible. Worship the God of the Ten Commandments, and you will make a good world. Worship anything else, no matter how noble-sounding, and you can too easily end up with evil. Reason. Reason, too, can become a false god. Like love, we cannot live without it, but we need more than reason to lead a good life and make a better world. Many people believe reason, without faith, is all we need to be moral and to make a moral world. In the words of the prominent American secular humanist and Yale professor of philosophy, Brand Blanchard, rationality or the attempt at it takes the place of faith. Take reason seriously. Let it shape belief and conduct freely. It will shape them aright if anything can. Blanchard was wrong. The belief that reason automatically leads to moral behavior is itself unreasonable, because reason is only a tool. Once you know what end you wish to achieve, reason becomes indispensable. If you want to build hospitals, you need reason. And if you want to build concentration camps, you need reason. But reason doesn't tell you for what ends you should be aiming. If you want to live completely for yourself, reason will help you do that. If you want to live a life of kindness to others, reason will help you do that. But reason doesn't tell you whether to be kind or to be self-centered. Reason just as easily argues for immoral actions as it does for moral actions. If you are a student who wants to get into a prestigious university, it is entirely reasonable to cheat on tests in order to do so. It is morally wrong, but it is reasonable because A, cheating can help you get into a more prestigious university. B, if you believe everyone else cheats, you will be at a clear disadvantage if you don't cheat. When the average German citizen remained silent while his Jewish neighbors were deported, he was acting entirely according to reason. Reason suggested not endangering one's life by aiding a Jew. In fact, it may be argued the only people in Nazi Germany who acted morally acted against reason. Similarly, it may be rational to kill infirmed babies, which is precisely what the ancient Greeks, the fathers of reason, did. But according to the God of this Torah, that is immoral. Not only does reason alone fail the morality test, it fails in determining a right response to almost every question involving values. For example, is it rational to have children? Yes and no. Reason argues both ways. Whether people, at least people who do not need children for economic reasons, have children, is far more a values question than a rational question. One proof is in industrialized societies, secular people have considerably fewer children than religious people of the same economic means. If you believe God wants you to have children, you are more likely to have children than if you care more about personal freedom, the ability to eat out, opportunities to travel, or for that matter, more time for reading and reflection. Is it rational to adopt a child who suffers from severe physical or emotional problems? Not really. Yet I have personally met many religious Christians who have done so. And when asked why they do this, they never respond, "It was the rational thing to do." They always respond with a religious reason. Simply put, reason without God-based moral values, beginning with the Ten Commandments, can become a false god. Reason is exactly like a map. No map shows where you should go, only how to get there. So too, reason tells you how to get to the place you want to go. But whether you want to use reason to get to a moral place or even know what a moral place is determined by your values. Nevertheless, it must be stressed that reason is a glory of the human mind. Anti-rational beliefs have often led to terrible evils. If you put reason first, you need God. And if you put God first, you need reason. Nothing guarantees goodness, but that combination offers the best hope for a moral world. religion and faith. Even religion and faith can be false gods when they hold that something other than goodness is God's primary demand. Neither faith nor ritual observance must be an end in and of itself. Both must be a means of making us better people by living according to God's moral will. The danger of religious false gods resides in every religion, even the most ethically demanding ones. In Judaism, there is the danger that preoccupation with ritual law, the laws between man and God, can overshadow the Torah's and the rest of the Hebrew Bible's demands of moral behavior above all. This is a major theme of the Hebrew prophets, who, speaking in God's name, repeatedly admonished the Jews to remember moral behavior, meaning proper treatment of fellow human beings, is God's foremost demand. Indeed, other than the Sabbath commandment and the ban on worshiping false gods, both of which are filled with ethical content, the Ten Commandments are all about moral behavior. In Christianity, there is also a danger. It is not posed by ritual law becoming more important than moral behavior, but by faith becoming more important than moral behavior. In the New Testament, James warns, "Faith without works is dead." James chapter 2, verse 20. But for much of Christian history, James's view did not prevail. It was a dangerous overemphasis on faith that allowed medieval Christian crusaders to murder entire Jewish communities in Germany on their way to the Holy Land. Their rationale for doing so was the Jews refused to accept Christian belief, and in the crusaders' minds should therefore convert or be killed. To the crusaders, right faith, not right conduct, was what mattered. Martin Luther, the father of the Protestant Reformation, broke with the Catholic Church on many issues. But on the issue of faith, Luther was even more extreme, insisting faith was incomparably more important than morality. As Luther expressed, "Be a sinner and sin vigorously, but even more vigorously believe and delight in Christ who is victory over sin, death, and the world. It is sufficient that we recognize through the wealth of God's glory the Lamb who bears the sin of the world. From this, sin does not sever us, even if thousands, thousands of times in one day we should fornicate or murder." It is not surprising, Luther even held the New Testament book of James in contempt. He described it as mere straw and without merit. Why? Because it attributes righteousness to works. Nor is it surprising Hitler and the Nazis idolized Luther because of the anti-Semitic sentiments that characterized his final years, a hatred emanating entirely from his placing faith above morality. Nevertheless, Luther made something much better than himself. What he helped to create, Protestant Christianity, ultimately became a gift to mankind. Among their other moral achievements, Protestants led the modern world's abolition of slavery, and they created the United States of America. One might say Protestants created much of the modern world. In Islam, both dangers exist, since both faith and ritual can overwhelm the moral. And for much of Islamic history, they have. One reason is the Quran has no prophets analogous to those of the Hebrew Bible, repeatedly berating Muslims for unethical behavior. Another is the Quran's division of humanity between believers, Muslims, and non-believers, non-Muslims and non-monotheists, rather than between good and evil. Money. As already noted, while there have always been people who live for acquiring money and material items, money is not a false god, because, unlike art, education, reason, religion, and faith, almost no one, even among those who do live for money, argues money is the highest good. So while it may function as a god, it is not believed in as a god. This commandment against other gods reflects one of the most important and pervasive themes in the Torah, the obliteration of false gods. It is so important that the Talmud states, with only a little exaggeration, "Whoever denies idolatry is considered to have fulfilled the whole Torah." This is why the seven basic laws Judaism traditionally has deemed obligatory on all people, the seven Noahide laws, do not obligate people to worship God. They demand the denial of all other gods. Verse 4. "You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above, or on the earth below, or in the waters under the earth." The primary purpose of this commandment is to prohibit images intended to be representations of God. As people tend to confuse image with essence, there is a danger that if God is depicted visually, people will confuse the depiction with God. In addition, they could come to believe God is a material being. By forbidding the making of images of God, the Ten Commandments prevents people from thinking of God as having a physical form. For example, you saw no shape when the Lord your God spoke to you at Horeb, Mount Sinai. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 15. The invisibility and incorporeality, no bodily form of God, are essential characteristics of the God of the Torah. If God were a physical being, he would be part of nature, not above and beyond it. And if God were material, there would be no immaterial reality. That in turn would mean there could not be an immaterial part of the human being, that is, the human soul. And if the human being has no soul, humans are merely material beings, not intrinsically more valuable than a pebble. Finally, if there is no soul, there is no afterlife. This commandment relates to the previous one, in that both can be understood as warnings against the potential dangers of art. Art is a false god, and using art to render God physical. This commandment, however, is not a prohibition against all art. The Torah is explicit about the importance of art and beauty in the construction of the tabernacle. But of course, that is art for the sake of bringing us closer to God. Indeed, there is room for all art, including the not explicitly religious that elevates people. Neither the Torah nor later Judaism is anti-art or material aesthetic beauty. The Torah does not prohibit people from building beautiful houses of prayer, such as synagogues and cathedrals, or for that matter, other beautiful buildings that are not devoted to false gods. As anyone who enters a beautiful house of prayer knows, the power of aesthetic magnificence to elevate the individual to contemplate the divine and experience the holy is considerable. We are physical beings, and we are moved by physical beauty. Clearly, then, that should be part of a God-centered life. Moreover, if we are going to spend money on the secular, we should also spend money on the religious. Many people who oppose spending money on beautiful houses of prayer are quite open to spending great amounts of money on art museums and concert halls, and for that matter on sports stadiums. But a society that spends large sums on the latter and minimal sums on houses of worship is not one I would wish to live in. That is precisely what is happening in Europe at this time. Expensive new museums and concert halls are regularly built, but virtually no new churches, reflecting the godless nature of most European societies. This does not bode well for Europe's future. Nevertheless, it is true to say that while the Torah places emphasis on using the visual and oral, that is, music, to bring people closer to God, Judaism has not been famous for its frescoes, figurines, or great art. According to Rabbi Gunter Plaut, prayer assumed the place of eminence denied to the visual arts. As he put it, because visual depictions of God were viewed as idolatrous, Jews developed beautiful ways of addressing God instead of beautiful ways of portraying God. As true as that is, some Jews, myself included, believe many synagogues built after the 1950s, compared to synagogues built before them, have been physically uninspiring. The same may be said of many modern churches. The larger secular culture often has an impact on religions. For reasons noted in detail in this commentary, the assertion that God is spiritual and non-physical is of particular importance. Maimonides included the belief in God's incorporeality as the third of his 13 principles of the Jewish faith. Of course, Christianity later held that God appeared in human form. From a Jewish perspective, this compromised the doctrine of an incorporeal God. But this unquestionably enabled many people to more easily relate to the divine. And by doing so, Christianity played a seminal role in bringing knowledge of the Torah and God to the world. Maimonides, who had profound disagreements with Christian theology, wrote it was through Christianity that the Torah, the Messianic hope, and the commandments have become familiar topics of conversation among the inhabitants of the Far Isles and many peoples. This commandment relates only to the visual arts. The Torah has no analogous limitation on music. Indeed, the Psalms are filled with accounts of praising God through musical instruments. For example, praise Him with timbrel and dance, praise Him with lute and pipe. Psalms 150, verse 4. The Torah is far more suspicious of the eye than of the ear, and rightly so. People are often led to sin when something glittering catches their eye, or when they are seduced by someone who is irresistibly attractive to the eye. This commandment reflects this understanding that, of all our senses, the eye has the greatest power to lead us astray. Numbers chapter 15, verse 39, when translated literally, enjoins people, "Do not follow your hearts and eyes, after which you prostitute yourselves." Asher atem zonim acharei chem. Verse 5. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. One reason the Torah forbids bowing to other gods is it recognizes behavior deeply influences the mind and the heart. Act kind and you'll feel kinder. Act happy and you'll feel happier. Bow down to idols and you'll start believing in them. Does God really get jealous? Verse 5 continued. For I, the Lord your God, am an impassioned God. The word translated here as impassioned literally means jealous, and in many Bible translations it is indeed rendered jealous. This statement is fodder for those who wish to mock the Bible. They ask, how impressive is a God who is jealous? A first response is that God, of necessity, must speak in terms understandable to human beings. This was recognized thousands of years ago by the rabbis of the Talmud, who said, the Torah speaks in the language of human beings. Dibra Torah Bilshon B'nei Adam. The moment God speaks to human beings, he is in effect compromising his godliness. If God spoke pure God talk, we humans would presumably understand nothing. The notion of God being a jealous God is a powerful message delivered in human terms. And what is this powerful message? God's jealousy is a statement of his love. That men and women who love their spouses occasionally feel, or at least are capable of feeling jealousy, means they love their spouses. Love does not exist where there is no possibility of jealousy. Of course, spouses should not too easily feel jealous. A perpetually jealous spouse will ruin a marriage. God wants his people to be faithful to him. God therefore likens his reaction to Israelite infidelity to that of a spouse whose husband or wife is unfaithful. This is neither foolish nor primitive. God is speaking in terms we can emotionally relate to, and he is humbling himself in order to describe as powerfully and humanly possible how much he loves his people. And of course, God knows the evils that ensue when people abandon him and worship false gods. See above. Does God punish the children of bad people? 1. Verse 5 continued, visiting the guilt of the parents upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generations of those who reject me. This statement is often understood to mean God will punish the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of those who hate God. The word translated above as reject literally means hate. The reason is so many translations, including the JPS translation used here, say God will visit the sins of the fathers unto the children. It is true that one meaning of the Hebrew verb poked is visit, but I believe the most accurate translation in this context is take account of, which is how the verb is often used in the Bible. See, for example, Exodus chapter 3, verse 16. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 18, and other biblical verses where the meaning is not visit, but take account of, and where the word has nothing to do with punishment. It is therefore very unlikely from a moral perspective, and the Ten Commandments form, after all, a moral document, the intent of the verse is God punishes the decent children and grandchildren of grievous sinners. First, the Torah has already established God is just, beginning with Abraham's argument with God over the destruction of Sodom, Genesis chapter 18. Second, if the verse really meant to say God punishes four generations of offspring for the sins of their ancestors, it would not only be unjust, it would be utterly counterproductive. It would be announcing that no matter how good a person you become, No matter how different a person you are from your God-hating father or grandfather, you will still be punished. And that alone would make someone hate God, legitimately. Third, the Torah itself expressly bans punishing children for the sins of their parents. Parents shall not be put to death for children, nor children be put to death for parents. A person shall be put to death only for his own crime. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 16. In contrast, the ancient Babylonian code of Hammurabi ruled that if a man acting negligently causes the death of his neighbor's son or daughter, the son or daughter of that man should be put to death. Paragraph 230. And the prophet Ezekiel announced, "The one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them." Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 20. What we probably have here are divine scare tactics. The Torah may be warning parents that if they are really bad and seek to undermine ethical monotheism, hate God is pretty severe, the chances are their children will suffer for what they have done, both because children suffer when their parents are bad people, and because they are more likely to follow in their parents' footsteps. Examples are legion. To cite but one example of each consequence, a son of Bernie Madoff, one of the greatest crooks in American history, committed suicide owing to the shame he felt over his father's crimes. And the worst mass shooting in American history as of this writing, leaving 58 people at an outdoor concert in Las Vegas dead and over 500 injured, was committed by a man whose father was a lifelong criminal and on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list. Fathers need to think about how they act. Their actions have enormous impact on their children. Does God punish the children of bad people? 2. Verse 6. But showing kindness to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. This part of the commandment would seem to prove God's previous statement about the third and fourth generation is not to be taken literally. If one takes the first part literally, that God punishes the children of evildoers to the fourth generation, then one must take the second part literally as well. God rewards the descendants of those who obey God for 1,000 generations. But that is as morally impossible as the first part. Does it mean that no matter how badly one behaves, he is shown kindness if his great-great-great-great-grandfather obeyed God? Of course not. Furthermore, how can it be decided which grandparent is the determinant of how his descendant is treated? If you go back just 10 generations, let alone 100, we all have slightly more than 1,000 grandparents, some of whom were wonderful human beings and some of whom were awful. Again, the point is didactic. In this case, God wants to contrast his desire to reward good with his need to punish bad. Regarding the words, "of those who love me," love of God, like hatred of God, refers not to feelings but to actions. The defining characteristic of loving God is keeping God's commandments, which means acting justly and treating people with decency and kindness. Verse 7. You shall not swear falsely by the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not clear one who swears falsely by his name. While the translation being used in this Torah commentary is that of the Jewish Publication Society, 1962, and one with which I sometimes disagree, though I hold it in very high regard, in this instance I believe the JPS translation is far off the mark. Indeed, I greatly prefer the older version of the 1917 JPS translation. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Swearing falsely in God's name, this translation, is much more narrow an understanding of this commandment than taking the name of the Lord in vain. Moreover, the word swear is not used. So what then does this commandment prohibit? Essay. The worst sin is committing evil in God's name. Is there such a thing as the worst sin? Apparently there is, and this is it. How do we know? Because it is the only one of the Ten Commandments whose violation God says he will not forgive. The Lord will not hold him guiltless. Literally, God will not cleanse the one who violates this commandment. But this immediately raises a question as obvious as it is troubling. Why, of all sins, would a moral and just God say the only person he will not forgive is one who takes his name in vain? What kind of God is prepared to potentially forgive stealing, giving false testimony, possibly even murder, but not forgive saying God's name for no important reason? Is murder potentially forgivable, but saying, "Oh God, did I have a tough day today," not forgivable? Obviously, this cannot be, and indeed, it is not. For one thing, the word God is not God's name. So saying something like, "God, did I have a tough day today," does not violate this commandment. God is God's title, but God's name is YHWH. We do not know exactly how it is pronounced, and Jews refrain from pronouncing it. It is this name in the Hebrew original we are forbidden to say in vain. But the ultimate and far more important reason this sin is unforgivable is due to something else, which can only be understood if we translate the verb of this commandment literally. Do not take is not what the commandment actually says. The Hebrew verb in the commandment, titzah, means carry. The commandment therefore reads, "Do not carry God's name in vain." And who carries God's name in vain? Any person who claims to be acting in God's name while doing the opposite of what God wants, evil. Obvious modern examples would include Islamist terrorists who shout, "Allahu Akbar," God is the greatest, when they murder innocent people. Or a priest or any other clergy who, utilizing the respect engendered by his clerical status, molests a child. There is little question Islamist terrorists and molesting clergy have both played a role in the rise of atheism in our time. When any person commits evil, it reflects badly on the person. But when a person commits evil in God's name, it reflects badly on God as well. The result is the only solution to evil. God-based morality is thoroughly undermined. When associated with evil, God and ethical monotheism are thoroughly discredited. And that is unforgivable, as it dramatically reduces the chances of creating a good world. No atheist activist is nearly as effective in alienating people from God and religion as are evil religious people. As noted, the Hebrew word yinake, hold guiltless, literally means cleanse. Essentially, God is saying if anyone dirties God's name, God will never cleanse that person's name. Verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Remember may refer to the fact the Israelites have already been made aware of the Sabbath. They already knew about the Sabbath from the cycle of the manna, which fell daily except for Shabbat. A double portion fell on Friday to provide food for Shabbat. See Exodus chapter 16, verses 21 through 30. More likely, however, remember means never forget to keep the Sabbath day. The careful reader will note this commandment does not say remember the Sabbath day to rest. While work is prohibited on Shabbat, our primary aim on the Shabbat should not be to rest. It should be to make it holy. Holy in Hebrew, kadosh, means separate or distinct. In this case, separate and distinct from the other 6 days of the week. Those 6 days are, one could say, the secular days of the week, while the Shabbat is the holy day. It is a day elevated, as the commandment goes on to say, to God. Therefore, we cannot just rest on the Sabbath. If we were to stay in bed from Friday night until Saturday night, though we would have certainly rested, we would not have kept the Shabbat. In fact, holy work is permitted, even though it is still work. For example, rabbis and cantors not only work on the Shabbat, it is the day of the week on which they work the hardest. But their work is related to making the Shabbat holy, and therefore permitted. Conversely, while shopping is hardly work, it is not related to making Shabbat holy, and therefore would violate the command to make the Sabbath day holy. Essay: Why the Sabbath commandment is unique. The Shabbat commandment is unique for at least three reasons, all of which underscore how important it is. First, it is one of only two of the Ten Commandments that ordain positive action. Other than honoring one's parents and the Shabbat, all the commandments are stated in the negative, "You shall not." Second, and even more remarkably, it is the only ritual commandment in the Ten Commandments. This almost surely means the Shabbat is the most important ritual in the Torah, and therefore in the Jewish religion. Why the Shabbat is so important for both the individual and the community will be explained, but it is worth noting here, more than any other Jewish ritual, the Shabbat preserved the Jewish people. As one major Jewish writer of the early 20th century, Ahad Ha'am, 1856 to 1927, put it, more than the Jews have kept the Shabbat has kept the Jews. There is yet another unique aspect to the Shabbat. It is not only the one ritual in the Ten Commandments, it is the one major ritual of the Torah and Judaism that is universally applicable. As ethically rooted as most Torah rituals are, including the laws of kosher food, as we shall see in Leviticus, there is no compelling reason for non-Jews to eat only kosher food. But there are very compelling reasons for non-Jews to observe the Shabbat. The world would be a better place, and people of every background would enjoy a higher quality of life if the Shabbat were widely observed. This further reinforces the belief that undergirds this commentary. The Ten Commandments are universally applicable. Traditionally, Judaism has not demanded the world embrace all Ten Commandments, but rather what it calls the seven laws of the children of Noah, the seven Noahide laws. And the Shabbat is not one of them. The obvious reason being, God did not prescribe the Shabbat to Noah or his descendants. But if one believes, as I do, the Ten Commandments should serve as the basic moral code for every civilization, it would include some form of the Sabbath. The Christian world is thus far the only non-Jewish civilization to have adopted the Ten Commandments, and societies that did so benefited immeasurably. The best example is the United States, the non-Jewish society that took the Ten Commandments the most seriously, as illustrated by the many sculptures of Moses holding the Ten Commandments throughout America, including on sculpted friezes inside and outside of the United States Supreme Court. Throughout their history, Americans widely observed the Sabbath on Sunday, until the radical secularization of America that began after World War II. The third reason the Shabbat commandment is unique is it is the only one of the Ten Commandments for which a reason is given. This is not a coincidence. Obviously, the only way to ensure people understand the theological point of the commandment, to affirm God as the Creator, is to say so. But there may be another reason for offering an explanation. The Torah recognizes a ritual is more compelling to many people when a reason is given for it. Sometimes, it is true, the reason for a ritual commandment is inscrutable, and we obey it solely because we believe God commanded it. But the human being is supposed to be a rational creature, and the Torah is overwhelmingly a rational document, meaning a document that accords with reason. God could have simply said, "Keep the Sabbath," without giving any reason to do so, but it would not have had the cosmic and universal meaning it has. While the Shabbat has a great deal of intrinsic meaning, the power of a day of rest, a day of sacred time, a day to connect with family and friends, God wanted us to know there is a monumental reason for the Shabbat. That reason is to affirm each week that God created the world, and just as He ceased from work on the seventh day, so do we. This is another reason the Sabbath is applicable to non-Jews. The reason God gives for the Sabbath is a universal one, not a specifically Jewish one. When Moses restates the Ten Commandments in the book of Deuteronomy, he provides a specifically Jewish reason for the Shabbat. The Israelites are to observe it because God released them from slavery in Egypt. And free people, unlike slaves, can choose not to work one day a week. I explain there why, I believe, Moses made that change. See commentary to Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15. Work is noble. Verse 9. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. There are those who take this as an obligation to work 6 days a week. Others regard it as a statement that one should do all one's work 6 days of the week so as to be able to desist from work on Shabbat. Whichever interpretation one subscribes to, one clear implication of these words is the Torah values labor. In the Torah, there are no negative associations with either labor or money. Like everything else, work and money can be directed toward noble or ignoble ends. But the Torah wants us to observe a day without work or monetary concerns. God matters, too. Verse 10. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In his book, The Sabbath, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel writes that we do not rest on the Sabbath so we can work during the week. Rather, we work during the week so we can rest and refresh our souls on the Sabbath. Man is not a beast of burden, and the Sabbath is not for the purpose of enhancing the efficiency of his work. The seventh day is the purpose and the culmination of the rest of the week, so much so that in Hebrew until this day, the days of the week are named in reference to their proximity to the Shabbat. Sunday is known as Yom Rishon, the first day toward the Sabbath. Monday is known as Yom Sheni, the second day toward the Sabbath, etc. Verse 10 continued. You shall not do any work. Only free people, not slaves, as the Israelites were in Egypt, and as so many other human beings were and are all over the world, can take a day off from work every week. By refraining from work on Shabbat, a person affirms his status as a free human being. Therefore, from the Torah's perspective, a person who works 7 days a week is a slave, even if he does so voluntarily. And if he earns a great deal of money by working 7 days a week, he would then simply be deemed a wealthy slave. The Sabbath is a time to reflect on the meaning of the work we did during the other 6 days. In this sense, Shabbat functions as a monastery, providing a weekly retreat from the world. Slaves, animals, and strangers must also have a Sabbath. Verse 10 continued. You, your son or daughter, your male or female slave, or your cattle, or the stranger who is within your settlements. This is one of the least quoted, yet most ethically revolutionary commandments in history. The Ten Commandments became the first and, as far as is known, the only legal code to grant slaves a weekly day of rest. See also Exodus chapter 23, verse 12. While the Bible did not universally abolish slavery, the Sabbath commandment was one of numerous commandments in the Torah that greatly humanized that terrible institution and eventually helped make slavery untenable to any society that venerated the Bible. By definition, slave owners throughout the world were under no obligation to allow a slave to ever rest, let alone to rest one day every week. Yet that is exactly what this commandment commanded. And by asserting a slave has fundamental human rights, the Torah began the arduous task of teaching people that slaves, too, are human beings. As regards animals not working on the Sabbath, one can accurately say the Ten Commandments were not only thousands of years ahead of their time, but ahead of their time today in almost every society that still uses animals for work. The Torah was also unique with regard to the stranger. In the ancient world and much of the world until today, the stranger has been regarded as outside the protection of the law, but not so in the case of the Torah. Exodus chapter 23, verse 12 makes clear the concern with the stranger, in order that your bondman and the stranger be refreshed. In these three ways, then, it is inaccurate to describe the Shabbat commandment as only ritual. It is profoundly and uniquely moral. The Sabbath, the ritual that affirms the Creator. Verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. Sarna makes the important point that the division of time into 7 days is not rooted in the natural. It is rooted in the supernatural, in God's creation of the world. The day corresponds to one complete rotation of the earth on its axis, and the month corresponds to one cycle of the moon's phases. But the week is completely disassociated from the movement of the celestial bodies. It is an unnatural and arbitrary measurement of time. Therefore, by observing the Shabbat every 7 days, one is worshiping the creator of nature, not nature, affirming the existence of a God who is above nature and who created it. That is the ultimate significance of Shabbat. It is a weekly public announcement that God created the world. There is no other ritual or ethical law in the Bible whose purpose is to affirm God as the creator of the world. As noted in the commentary to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, that verse, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," is arguably the most important verse in the Bible. The entire Bible rests on that claim. Life, having ultimate meaning, rests on it. If there is no creator, there is no design and no purpose. All is random and ultimately meaningless, including right and wrong. Every time a person observes the Shabbat, especially in the presence of people who do not believe in the God of the Bible, that person is affirming God created the world, and all is not random. I experienced this when I was a university student in England. One Saturday afternoon, I was lying on my bed reading a book when my non-Jewish roommate happened to stop by the apartment. Seeing me lying down midday, he asked if I was feeling all right. I told him I felt perfectly fine. So he asked me, "Why are you lying down?" "It's my Sabbath," I responded, "and I'm resting." He was obviously taken aback. A physics major and an atheist, it is doubtful he ever encountered a believer, let alone one living out his faith. "You believe in God?" he asked incredulously. "I do." "What's God?" he immediately asked, with more than a hint of disdain. Knowing he was a scientist, I answered, as matter-of-factly as I could, "God is the only absolute in a universe of relativity." "Oh." It was apparent he was surprised that a religious person could utter an intellectual-sounding sentence, especially about God. But what made the biggest impact on me was I had lived out the mandate of the Sabbath commandment, publicly affirming the Creator. We affirm the Creator by not working on the seventh day. For that reason alone, our increasingly godless world needs people who will observe the Sabbath and invite others to celebrate it with them. The personal impact of the Sabbath. As if all the above achievements of the Sabbath were not enough, there is one other as important as any of them: the impact on your life if you have a Sabbath in it. When a person takes off from work one day every week to keep the Sabbath, that day almost inevitably becomes a day spent with people, which means family and or friends. The biggest reason people are not generally with family and friends is work. Therefore, with no work allowed, what else is one going to do if not spend much of the day with people? People inevitably spend the Sabbath with friends and family. For many Jews throughout history, Shabbat has meant family day more than anything else, especially the hours-long Friday night and Saturday afternoon meals. In my parents' home, Shabbat, particularly Friday evening, was more or less the only time I engaged in protracted conversation with my parents. Shabbat has similar positive effects on marriages. Ask anyone married to a workaholic how good it would be for his or her marriage if the workaholic would not work for one day each week, and you can appreciate the power of the Sabbath day. The uniqueness of the commandment to honor our parents. Verse 12. Honor your father and your mother. This is the first of the Ten Commandments addressing only human-to-human relations. As such, it would seem to belong to the second of the two tablets, all five of whose commandments likewise only address human-to-human behavior. Yet it is listed among the first five, immediately following the commandment to observe the Sabbath. Both of these commandments serve as a bridge between relating to God and relating to people. The Sabbath begins with acknowledging God as the Creator, and leads to proper treatment of servants, animals, and strangers. As for parents, they are, along with God, our co-creators, biologically and non-biologically. And honoring parents is a building block of civilization. Societies in which parents are honored will long survive, which is precisely what the commandment soon says. There is another way in which this commandment is a bridge between God and man. If a child does not honor parental authority, he is less likely to honor divine authority, and the converse is also true. There is a hierarchy in life without which moral order is unlikely: God, parent, child. As noted, this commandment and the one for the Sabbath are the only two of the ten rendered in the positive. The other commandments tell us what not to do. Remember, the first, even in the original Jewish enumeration, is a statement, not a commandment ordaining behavior. This fact alone tells us how important God deems honoring parents. In effect, the Ten Commandments tell us to do only two things: remember the Sabbath and honor our father and mother. The unique importance of this commandment is further underscored by the fact there is no other commandment in the Torah, not just in the Ten Commandments, demanding we honor someone or something. Essay: We are not commanded to love our parents. The Torah commands us to love God, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, to love our neighbor, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, and to love the stranger who dwells among us, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 34. But in a particularly compelling example of the Torah's psychological sophistication, it does not command us to love our parents. Why? One reason is such a command would either be superfluous or impossible to obey. Those who already love their parents don't need to be commanded to do so, while those who do not love their parents could not be commanded to do the impossible. The Torah understands how often child-parent relations are emotionally troubled. Another reason, and the more essential one, is it is more important to honor parents than to love them. It is a beautiful thing when children love their parents. But many, perhaps most people experience a variety of emotions toward their parents throughout their lifetimes, sometimes dependent on the parents' behavior, and sometimes dependent on the child's own emotional evolution and psychological makeup. The moral success of a society does not depend on children loving parents. It does depend on children honoring their parents. An analogy might help here. It would be very nice if everyone in a society loved their city's police and their country's president, but that is utopian. What matters much more to a functioning society is that citizens honor the police and their president. And just as people who did not vote for or even vigorously oppose a president stand when he enters a room, so too children who do not love a parent must still honor their parent. Yes, there are parents who are so evil, not just annoying, obnoxious, or ill-tempered, but actually evil, it is impossible for their child to relate to, let alone honor them. But in the overwhelming majority of cases, a parent's failings do not amount to evil. Moreover, the Torah does not command us to always obey our parents, but to honor them. The distinction between honor and obedience is highlighted in a later Torah verse: "You shall each revere his mother and father and keep my Sabbaths," Leviticus chapter 19, verse 3. The Talmud explains the juxtaposition of these two laws this way: we must obey our parents, but not if they tell us to violate the Sabbath. In biblical Hebrew, the word "and," which is actually just a single letter, vav, attached to the beginning of a word, often means "but." See, for example, Psalms 96, verse 5. Thus, the Leviticus verse would be more accurately translated, "You shall each revere his mother and father, but keep my Sabbaths." In other words, there is a moral authority higher than one's parents: God. Accordingly, if our parents tell us to do something that violates God's will, we are to respectfully decline to obey. The Talmud offers an example of a father who instructs his child not to return a lost item. The child is not to obey, though admittedly that is a lot to ask of a young child. Though we do not owe our parents control of our conscience, we do still owe them honor. Maimonides writes, "If one sees his father violating a Torah law, he should not say, 'Father, you have violated the Torah.' Rather, he should say, 'Father, is it not written in the Torah?' as if he were asking a question, not delivering a warning." Those who find it difficult to honor a parent and find themselves often arguing with or even shouting at a parent should nevertheless attempt to find a way to observe this commandment. For example, sometimes it might be easier to honor one's parents by not living near them. In other instances, it might be best to avoid prolonged stays with one's parents. Whatever it takes to keep this commandment is worth pursuing. Additional points. Implicit in the commandment to honor parents is the expectation for parents to act in ways that elicit their children's respect. This means, first and foremost, parents must act honorably. It is difficult to honor parents who act dishonorably, such as parents who act criminally, who are dysfunctional due to drug or alcohol addiction, or who treat the other parent with contempt. It also means parents must act as their children's parents, not as their peers. As much as parents may want to be honored, and they should want to be, children need to honor their parents for